Hi, everyone, and welcome to this class number 5 in our course on the Book of Ruth. As always, please do consult my personal website, www.drchad.faithweb.com, and there you can access not only the PDF of the handout for today's class that includes some reflection questions that you may enjoy not only journaling from or maybe in discussion with others if perhaps you're doing this as a small group, but there's also a link to the MP3 download of the audio of the class and a link to the video, as well as all of the other classes in this course and many other resources that are available there for you. Now, today in our class on the Book of Ruth, we're going to actually do the entire second chapter. We're going to read the entire second chapter and then kind of dive in from there as we move further into this story. So I now want to read Ruth chapter 2. It's a bit lengthy, so bear with me, but as we do so, just listen as the story goes along. I'll be reading today from what is known as the Tree of Life version of the Bible, the translation known as the Tree of Life. It's a Hebraic roots translation. It's one of the translations that I prefer in the English. So the text reads like this. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from Elimelech's family, a prominent man of substance whose name was Boaz. But the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Please let me go out to the field and glean grain behind anyone in whose eyes I may find favor." Naomi said to Ruth, "Go ahead, my daughter." So Ruth went out and gleaned in the field behind the reapers. She just so happened to be in the field of Boaz, who was from Elimelech's family. And you catch that. She just so happened to be in that field. Soon after Boaz arrived from Bethlehem, he said to the harvesters, "The Lord be with you." And they replied, "May the Lord bless you." Then Boaz asked the foreman of his harvesters, "Whose young woman is this?" "She is a Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the region of Moab," the foreman replied. "She asked, 'Please allow me to glean and gather among the barley sheaves behind the harvesters.' So she came and has been working in the field since morning until now, except for a little while in the shelter." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen to me, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or even pass on from here, but stay close to my female workers. Keep your eyes on the field that they are harvesting and follow after them. I strongly ordered the young men not to touch you. When you are thirsty, you can go to the jars and drink from the water the young men have drawn." She fell upon her face and bowing down to the ground and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you have noticed me, even though I am a foreigner?" And Boaz replied and said to her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since your husband's death has been fully reported to me. How you left your father and mother in the land of your birth and came to a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done, and may you be fully rewarded by the Lord, God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." She said, "May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your maidservant, even though I am not one of your maidservants." At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here and eat some bread and dip your piece into the wine vinegar." So she sat beside the harvesters, and he held out to her roasted grain. She ate until she was full, and some was still left. When she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his workers, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves. Do not humiliate her. Also be sure to pull out some grain for her from the sheaves and leave them for her to pick up, and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. When she thrashed what she had gathered, there was about an ephah of barley. She carried it back to town, where her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. Ruth took out some of what she had and gave what was left over after eating her fill. Her mother-in-law asked, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? May the one who noticed you be blessed." She told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The name of the man for whom I worked is Boaz." So Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, who has not stopped his kindness to the living or to the dead. Then Naomi said to her, This man is closely related to us, one of our kinsmen redeemers. Then Ruth the Moabitess said, He even said to me, Stay close to my workers until they have finished the entire harvest. Naomi answered her daughter-in-law Ruth, It is good, my daughter-in-law, that you go out with his female workers, so that you will not be harmed in another field. So she stayed close to Boaz's family workers, gleaning until both the barley harvest and the wheat harvest were completed. Meanwhile, she still lived with her mother-in-law. And here ends Ruth chapter 2. In 1956, C.S. Lewis wrote a letter to a young American writer, and he offered the following advice, quote, Don't use words that are too big for the subject. Don't say infinitely when you simply mean very. Otherwise, you'll have no word left when you actually want to talk about something that is really infinite. Words matter, and it is easy to overstate. But there's an equally important flip side to C.S. Lewis's advice, namely using words that are too small for the subject. That too small problem comes up when we translate a Hebrew word known as chesed. Chesed is a Hebrew word that is loaded with power. There are just some of these words in Scripture that are very special, that are very unique, that are just pregnant with meaning. And chesed is one of those Hebrew words in the Bible. It's an incredibly important word throughout the Bible, and it's incredibly important in the book of Ruth. Now, technically, the Hebrew word chesed only shows up in the book of Ruth three times, but the concept runs throughout the whole story and ultimately drives the action. Naomi says it first when she attempts to part from her daughter-in-law. She says, May the Lord show chesed to you, as you have shown to your dead and to me, in Ruth chapter 1, verse 8. And then she says the word chesed again in chapter 2, verse 20, when Ruth brings home her gleanings, and we just read that portion. He has not stopped showing his chesed to the living and the dead. And then Boaz will use the word chesed to describe Ruth's actions when he proposes marriage to her in chapter 3. This chesed is greater than that which you showed earlier. Chesed is driven by a loyal, selfless love, a love that motivates a person to do voluntarily what no one has a right to expect or ask of them. It's actually the kind of love that we find most fully expressed in Jesus, our Messiah. In a nutshell, chesed is the gospel lived out. The challenge for the reader of the book of Ruth is that English translations of the word chesed often simply are too small and don't begin to convey either the power of chesed or its prominence in the story. So we have a little bit of what I would call lost in translation. The core of the struggle is that the English language does not have a one word equivalent for the one word chesed. It's not that in English you can't say what chesed means, it's just you have to use more than one word. There is no one-for-one correlation between chesed and some English word that we have. Rather, chesed kind of employs, embodies, and utilizes what would be several different English words. And so this always puts translators in a bit of a quandary. In the search for an appropriate translation or substitute for chesed, English translators are offered a smorgasbord of options. And so we read words translated from the single Hebrew word chesed. We find the words in English, kindness, mercy, loyalty, loving kindness, covenant faithfulness, loyal, steadfast, unfailing love. And sometimes just love, our just grace, our just mercy. Words that certainly all touch on the concept of what chesed means, but in and of themselves do not begin to do justice to this powerful, richly laden word. As a result, we can easily skim over references to chesed without realizing we've just stumbled over one of the most potent words in the entire Bible. Chesed is the way God intended for human beings to live together from the beginning, the love your neighbor as yourself brand of living, an active, selfless, sacrificial caring for one another that goes against the grain of our fallen natures. Chesed is a costly brand of love that involves going above and beyond what anyone has a right to ask or to expect. It is the brand of love that's at work in the actions of Ruth, in the actions of Boaz, and ultimately in the actions of Naomi too. God is the ultimate chesed giver. The confidence and hope of God's people banks on the fact that, as it says in Exodus 34, verse 6, that the Lord is abounding in chesed. The weeping prophet Jeremiah comforted himself in the midst of the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, the exile of God's people. He comforted himself by reminding himself that as he says in Lamentations chapter 3, because of the Lord's great chesed, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. And so the book of Ruth really puts God's chesed on display for us. And we will learn along with Naomi that God's chesed love, it's indiscriminate, it's unearned, it's persistent. The Lord's chesed will reach Naomi through the selfless and relentless commitment of Ruth to fight for her, and Boaz will join Ruth in this effort. Events in the field of Boaz on that day we just read about in the second chapter of Ruth, they give Naomi a fresh insight into the Lord's chesed. And what Naomi learns is actually something that's indispensable to us. Because so often we struggle to put our suffering and our challenges and our difficulties and our days of chaos, we struggle to put that and God's chesed, his love, his kindness, his mercy, his steadfast faithfulness to us. We struggle to put those two things together in our own stories, just as Naomi did. So here again is where Naomi's story really becomes our story. So battling hunger. Apparently the morning after arriving in Bethlehem, Naomi is engulfed in grief and hopelessness. She's convinced that God's chesed for her, that it has completely evaporated, and he has turned against her. And we've talked about that in previous classes, how Naomi draws that straight line between her suffering and her difficulties and her losing her husband and her losing her sons and having no hope of posterity in this patriarchal culture, how she draws a straight line from all of that right to God. From Naomi's perspective, it appears that the Lord has destroyed her past and stolen her future. She has given up on life. So it is not surprising that she takes a rather passive role in tackling the first challenge that Ruth and Naomi face on their arrival in Bethlehem. It's a pretty simple, basic problem, but a very real problem. They arrive in Bethlehem and they have no food. And so Ruth is quite different than Naomi here. Where Naomi is passive, Ruth is anything but passive. Ruth actually initiates action. And despite her own grief, and despite the insecurities that naturally accompany arriving in a foreign country, Ruth has not forgotten her impassioned vow to care for her mother-in-law. And so Ruth wastes no time in making good on her promise. She decides to glean, and Naomi gives her assent. Consent. In Ruth chapter 2, verse 2, Naomi simply says, "Go ahead, my daughter." Now, and I think it was our first class in this course, we talked about three specific laws in the Torah that Naomi and Ruth and Boaz kind of confront and challenge and reinterpret. One was the levirate marriage, and we've already seen how Naomi presented that and how Ruth countered that and really understood the spirit of the law instead of the spirit of the law with levirate marriage. Now we're going to see the second of those three laws, and that is the gleaning law. And then eventually we'll see what is known as the kinsman redeemer law. But I want to make sure we get the context straight here. And that is, gleaning was Israel's welfare system. Not just kinda, or not just sorta. It was literally Israel's welfare system. It was a way for the poor. It was a way for the widow. It was a way for the orphan. It was a way for the alien in our midst, the immigrant, the foreigner, the refugee. It was a way for all of them to be able to sustain themselves by scavenging leftover grain from community fields. In other words, the first thing Ruth did, literally on their first full day in Israel, is Ruth, the immigrant, went to the welfare office to get benefits. It's exactly what so many fear and even detest about foreign immigrants, that they are going to mooch off of our system, that they're going to take what is ours and take what we have earned. And yet here we have the ancestor of King David. We have a biological ancestor of Jesus the Messiah, who as a foreign immigrant immediately goes on welfare. And no one seems to be calling her names. The Mosaic gleaning law, the law of gleaning found in the Bible, in the Torah, can be found in Leviticus chapter 19, as well as Deuteronomy chapter 24. And there, what the law requires is that a landowner leave the corners and the edges of his field unharvested. That when they harvest their field, they're to leave the edges and the corners alone. And then after they've cleared their fields, harvesters were not allowed to also go back and to pick up what they've missed. As Deuteronomy says, they were to, quote, leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 20. So if you own land, if you were a farmer, you had to leave the corners and the edges of your field unharvested. Then when you harvested your field, you couldn't go back over it. You only got to go over it once. And then people in the community, the less fortunate, the widows, remember this is a patriarchal culture, the widows and the orphans and the immigrants and those who were really struggling to survive got to go to those unharvested corners and edges and harvest. And they could also glean and pick up anything that might have fallen or been left behind in the field. This is what God put into the law to make sure that the least among them in their communities were provided for. It's a welfare system. Hired male harvesters would cut the grain. Female harvesters followed to gather the grain into bundles to be carted off to the threshing floor. Once the harvesters were finished, gleaners could gather up whatever scraps remained. In an ancient Near Eastern shame-based culture, gleaning was just that. It was a source of shame, much like being on welfare now or individuals receiving food stamps. They could feel that that is a source of shame, or others could try to shame them for doing that, and instead of trying to seek to understand that they've really hit hard times or unexpected medical expenses came along, a whole host of reasons why someone might very legitimately and very deservedly so need to be receiving assistance. Instead of seeing it that way, often these systems are seen as sources of shame. In the ancient Near Eastern culture, to glean was a public display of poverty. In Israel, poverty itself was not a moral problem. The problems for the Israelites were the loss of status and shame that the poverty actually entailed. As an Old Testament scholar Hubbard explains, quote, "The gleaning of fallen grain was mere subsistence living, much like trying to eke out survival today by recycling aluminum cans." In Israel, for someone like Naomi, who was once a respected member of the Bethlehem community, it must have been a blow to her sense of dignity for her daughter-in-law to join the ranks of the gleaners. Scholar André Lechocq notes, quote, "The brevity of the permission given to Ruth in chapter 2, verse 2, where she simply just says, 'Go ahead,' right, expresses Naomi's despondency. The two women had arrived at the bitter end of subsistence, and they have nothing more to lose." So danger in the promised land. When we look at this, we do Ruth an enormous disservice if we fail to acknowledge the risks that were involved in her decision to become a gleaner. This was the dreaded day when Ruth would come face to face with the realities and the reasons why Naomi tried to discourage her and send her back to Moab. This is exactly what Naomi feared. Ruth's decision to venture out alone in a foreign culture without a friend in the world was precarious, to say the least. The prospect of harm surely compounded Naomi's fragile state of mind by adding a boatload of anxiety that day. And so we must not minimize the serious threats unprotected women have historically faced. The reality for Ruth and Naomi and even Boaz underscore all of this. To protect Ruth from abuse or injury in his field, Boaz instructs his male harvesters to not lay a hand on her. Chapter 2, verse 9. At the end of the day, when Ruth returns home safely, a relieved Naomi encourages her and urges her to continue gleaning in that particular field. Because as she says in verse 22, in someone else's field, you might be harmed. If Ruth is asking Boaz for permission to glean, as it seems she is in the text, she's drawing unnecessary and potentially dangerous attention to herself by asking for permission to do what the law of Moses, what the Torah already required Boaz to do and what Boaz was already doing and allowing. According to more recent scholarship, Ruth has evidently elected to request permission to go beyond the normal custom. Given the meager fare that gleaners probably gathered, one suspects a concern increases your chances of gleaning, not only enough for you, but Ruth's got to do it for Naomi as well. And Ruth showed herself to be anything but modest or self-effacing. Rather, she emerges courageous, if not outright brash. She willingly took a sizable risk in order to benefit her mother-in-law, because she doesn't know at this point that Boaz is this good dude. And so going and exposing herself to Boaz as this foreign widow who's got no shot at anything in this life, this individual could have taken great advantage of Ruth. This individual could have done great harm to Ruth. But Ruth risks it because Ruth has promised her chesed to her mother-in-law, Naomi. So danger threatens Ruth really from three different fronts. First, Ruth faces danger from other hungry gleaners who are scrambling for scant gatherings as well. Even the presence of one more gleaner obviously means less for everyone else. The barley field could easily become a battlefield of gleaners competing and fighting over very limited resources. Young female foreign and presumably wearing garments that mark them as widow, Ruth is an easy target for greedy gleaners who might choose to seize whatever grain she managed to collect. And second, Ruth faces danger at the hands of the hired harvesters. Before Boaz even speaks to Ruth, he has drawn a line around her that his workers must not cross. And otherwise, it's indicating they probably would have. Harvesters were common laborers who worked under the thumb of the landowner. their daily take-home pay, a half a pound to a pound of grain, according to Babylonian records, would never get them ahead in life. Harvesters occupied a low level in Bethlehem's power pyramid, but gleaners ranked even lower. And so harvesters could find it tempting to take out their resentment on gleaners by pulling rank and mistreating them. There's a tendency among human beings to pass their pain and frustrations onto those less powerful and less fortunate. It's a reoccurring pattern in history. It's even a reoccurring pattern in our work life and even in our family life. When someone over us gives us a hard time and a hard day, we find the person we're over and we give them a hard time and a hard day. It happens at every level of a patriarchal cultural structure. So for a young, defenseless woman like Ruth, the possibility of sexual assault is very present, even in the field of a good man like Boaz. And third and most surprising, Boaz, at least initially, for all intents and purposes for what Ruth knew, she didn't know who Boaz was, Boaz poses a threat. The storyteller opens this scene by introducing Boaz as a towering figure. It uses the Hebrew word kail. The Hebrew word used here indicates that he's a man of valor, of stature, of wealth, of privilege, of power. The word kail conjures up the image of an elite warrior similar to the hero of the Homer epics. Considering that the days when the judges ruled were characterized by frequent wars, and Boaz is one of these judges, it's very likely he was a military hero. He's also identified twice as Elimelech's relative, a fact that Naomi later will confirm. Ruth is not privy to any of this information. From her perspective, Boaz simply represents power. The disparity between the two of them couldn't be more pronounced. And we're supposed to notice this. This is supposed to be something glaring out of the text. The story is intended to pose the question, what will Boaz do with his power? From Ruth's perspective, Boaz is a serious threat. The world is full of stories of powerful village strongmen who abuse their powers, especially against widows, in horrific ways. So it is astonishing that before Boaz arrives, and without knowing whether he is a safe person, Ruth has already taken a gutsy chance. These are things that we must fully appreciate in the story. Sanctuary. That Ruth ends up in the field of Boaz, as the text sort of makes it sound like, oh, she just happens to land there. We know that, as we said in our first class, the story of Ruth is really the story of God. And so we know Ruth doesn't just accidentally or just happen to land in Boaz's field, and it could have been one of 30 other fields. We know it wasn't just happenstance. Clearly, the Lord is providentially guiding the steps of his daughter into this particular field. But so often we minimize the Lord's place in the story if we fail to recognize how powerfully he is working in other ways, and in particularly how powerful he is working on not only Ruth's behalf, but how powerful he is working on Naomi's behalf. Ruth's arrival in the field of Boaz marks the beginning of a divine shakeup in the village of Bethlehem. Traditional interpretations view Boaz as the true leader and the hero of the story of the book of Ruth, assuming that this powerful, rich man of valor will reverse the flagging fortunes of these two widows, Ruth and Naomi. But it is actually Ruth. Ruth is the one who proves to be the true leader in the story, as she seeks to live out as God's child and to battle on Naomi's behalf. Her actions demonstrate a vibrant, a radical faith to a community that has settled for precision obedience to God's law. And so by the time Boaz arrives on the scene, God is already powerfully present in the field through the young Moabite immigrant who will dare to challenge the system and to upend the status quo. When Ruth arrives at the barley field of Boaz, she is in battle mode for Naomi, not for herself. Even before Boaz speaks in her defense, she has found sanctuary, not in culturally recognized safe zones or under the protection of a man. She has found refuge under God's wing, and that is the solid basis from which she operates. In one of our earlier courses, I mentioned how Ruth existed on the so-called hungry side of the law. Boaz sees a newcomer in his field and learns from his overseer that she is, quote, a Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi, Ruth 2, verse 6. The overseer then proceeds to tell his boss, Boaz, all about Ruth's audacious request. It goes without saying that gleaning wasn't a lucrative business. This hand-to-mouth existence is still practiced in some parts of the world today. Locally, it can often amount to rummaging through a garbage bin outside a McDonald's in search of a leftover Big Mac or some discarded fries. Several years ago, when I was a pastor at a different congregation in the state of Kentucky, I served on the board of directors for over a decade and was even part of starting this thrift shop. The benefits of the thrift shop were then to fund a free clinic in the community. But one of the things we learned in running this thrift shop as it became large and quite successful is that many people would donate things that we really couldn't resell or that weren't in the condition to sell, or in some cases that we weren't legally allowed to resell or offer up. And so we would started throwing things away in a dumpster. But what we found was in the evening, individuals were going in through our dumpsters, and this really provided a hazard and a liability for us, because they were crawling into a dumpster. Therefore, there was the possibility that someone could get injured, someone could get stuck in there, a garbage truck could come while someone's in there. A whole host of a litany of insurance liabilities went through our head of, it's probably not good to just let people rummage through our garbage. And at times, it wasn't always left in a neat accord. They just kind of started chunking stuff out to see what they could have. But we took seriously, because we were a faith-based organization, we actually took seriously the gleaning law. Now, we didn't have barley and wheat fields, so we weren't literally understanding the gleaning law, but we were in a spiritual sense understanding the gleaning law. We realized that even though we were selling jeans for $1 or $2 and shirts for 50 cents and shoes for $1, we realized that even that might be too much for some people. For some families with lots of kids and it being back to school, that even thrift store prices could be too much. And we realized that, you know what? We should let people have some of our legitimate stuff, our good stuff, the stuff that we can sell, that we could sell, that we would definitely sell. We should still set some of that aside and absolutely give that away. And so what we did is we actually built a different kind. It wasn't a dumpster, but we kind of built this kind of that was weatherproof and so forth. But in many ways, it was the corner of our field. We put it out back, but we put it where you could easily access it, so you didn't have to get close to our building. The police wouldn't think you were trying to break in, or you wouldn't set off our alarm or any of those other issues. And we would just put stuff in there, good stuff. And we let people glean there. And people respected that. It was never left messy. It was never left destroyed. People never did harm to it. And we would just, hey, we've got 6 pair of jeans donated. Let's put 2 in the gleaning box. And we just put them in the box and not charge a dime and just let whoever needed that come and get it. All right. And so that's a very modern day example where the gleaning law, the spirit of the gleaning law, was put into effect. Now, the odds are slim that Ruth is going to be able to return home with enough food for herself and for Naomi, especially with other gleanings competing for what grain remains. And that was Ruth's kind of bold request. When she was saying, let me glean, she already had permission to glean. It was already required by the law of Moses, and Boaz was already obeying the law of Moses. But she was saying, I need a little more. Can you help me get a little more? Now, Boaz is an honorable man, a man who complies with the Torah. He upholds the Torah. He obeys the Moses law. He permits gleaners in his field. But Ruth doesn't want to take home scraps to her mother-in-law. So she makes a bold, outrageous request to Boaz's supervisor and ultimately to Boaz. Instead of scavenging for snippets of grain, she wants to glean where freshly cut grain is lying on the ground. You see, Ruth is bold because she lives on the hungry side of the law, and the law looks very different from that point of view. Her proposal presses Boaz beyond the letter of the law to fulfill its spirit. So here is where Ruth challenges the gleaning law in the Torah. We saw where she's done it with the lever, or where Naomi has done it with the Levirate marriage. We're seeing Ruth now challenging one, the gleaning law. Ruth is basically saying to Boaz, look, I know that the letter of the law, the gleaning law, says, let them glean. That's what the letter of the law says, that you have to let us glean. It doesn't tell you how much you have to let us glean. It doesn't tell you how big the corners of the field have to be or how long the edges have to be. It gives you no specifics. It just says, leave the corners unharvested and let the poor, the widow, the orphan, the immigrant, let them glean. It doesn't say how long you have to let them glean. It doesn't say there's a minimum amount that they can get. It doesn't say there's a maximum amount. It doesn't say, again, how big the corners of your field are to be. It just says, let them glean. That's the letter of the law. Right? And so you can imagine someone could quickly check that off their list. They could make their corners really, really, really small. And then it wouldn't be that big a deal, right? But they technically would have obeyed the law. But what Ruth is saying is, look, with God, it's not about the letter of the law. It's about the spirit of the law. While the letter says, let them glean, the spirit says, feed them. That was the real intent of the law. And that's what Ruth is saying. The real reason God wrote this law wasn't so you could check off a box on a checklist and so that you could find a loophole and get out of this. He put this in there because you are to feed the hungry. That's the real purpose of this law. Move beyond the letter and see the spirit. It is indeed to feed the hungry. Her brazen request creates a healthy conflict of interest for Boaz, as it should. The gleaning law, again, doesn't specify how wide an edge or how big a corner is to be or how scrupulously harvesters are to clear the field. And undoubtedly, landowners always wrestle with how much they are to leave for those with less and how much they can keep for themselves. But in the aftermath of a prolonged and devastating famine, remember the context of Ruth, the famine has just ended. You know this struggle would be incredibly difficult for a landowner. Boaz has just endured a famine. He's just now getting crops again. How eager do you think he is to have gleaners on his property? But instead of taking offense, Boaz's response is as radical as Ruth's proposal. This powerhouse of a man, this native-born Israelite who grew up on the law of Moses in the Torah, listens to this newcomer's request, learns from her, and throws his power behind her effort. He is obviously committed to God's law, but his actions here and his actions, as we'll see even later at the threshing floor, demonstrate his willingness to adopt a broader interpretation of the law. He, like others in Bethlehem, is in awe of what Ruth has done for her mother-in-law, Naomi, and he swiftly issues a series of executive orders to guarantee her success. Not only does he ensure her safety, as she, with his permission, now ventures into territory that is normally off limits to gleaners, but he fuels her efforts by he himself actually providing her with food and water. At mealtime, he invites her to join his workers and serves her a meal of roasted grain and giving her on purpose more than she can eat. He grants her access to water that's drawn by his workers. He further instructs his harvesters to pull out stalks of grain from the bundles and place them in her path so she can glean even more. In the end, she will take home far more than any of the harvesters earned that day for their labor. And so here we're going to see that this has the effect of reviving Naomi. Naomi's astonishment upon Ruth's return is one of the priceless whiplash moments in the Bible. After what would have been for most a miserable day of anxiety, Naomi's worst fears are not realized. Ruth doesn't arrive shattered with accounts of violence and rape and mistreatment. Instead, she walks in the door with 29 pounds of winnowed barley, at least half a month's pay for a male harvester. She then presents Naomi with, who has got to be hungry, right? Provides her with roasted grain from the meal Boaz served her. It's the first fast food meal in the Bible. It's hard to describe Naomi's surprise as her excited questions and words of blessing spill out. Ruth 2:19, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." It is obvious to Naomi that it was impossible for Ruth to glean as much as she did without some kind of extraordinary extra help. When she learns that the man is Boaz, her exuberance continues. Naomi says, "The Lord bless him. He has not stopped showing his kindness, his chesed, to the living and the dead." In the Hebrew text, the word "he" is ambiguous. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. It technically could be referring to Boaz or to God. And in the classic case of Hebraic thought, the ambiguity actually invites the answer, it's both. The Lord's preferred method of getting things done is to work through his image bearers. And so God's chesed comes to Naomi through her daughter-in-law and now also through Boaz. But of course, ultimately and really, always from God. It is a dramatic turning point for this female Job. This is the moment when Naomi's hope in God revives, not because she senses a budding romance, nor because a little good fortune cures her heartache. It's a turning point for her because she now senses God's chesed in the unexpected abundance of barley before her. Grief sensitizes God's child to any evidence of God's presence. In the dark, we strain our eyes for the slightest hint of him. Something Naomi would never have noticed in more prosperous times now speaks volumes of chesed to her God-starved soul and, in essence, raises Naomi back from the dead. Awareness of God's unfailing chesed for her breathes new life into grieving Naomi's soul. The Lord does love her, after all. And although she is a zero in the eyes of the culture, although she has lost everything that might cause someone in that culture to value her, although her life has been reduced to rubble and her future destroyed, she is learning that God is not finished with her yet. God is not finished with Naomi yet. God has a strategic kingdom work for Naomi that she will be uniquely equipped to do. The Naomi we encounter hereafter is no longer thinking of herself. She's focused on her daughter-in-law, Ruth, and so she now becomes a chesed giver, too. And Ruth, in the following scene, will put good use to the information she picks up from Naomi, that, as it says in verse 20, "The man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers." And that is what we will explore in our next class. Thanks for tuning in today. Let's close with the blessing after the study of Scripture. Baruch atah Adonai, noten hadavar. Blessed are you, Lord God, who has given to us the gift of the Holy Scriptures. Amen. Shalom, shalom.